are we on? So by the way, yesterday's videos are online, and I think I gave you, I wrote the URL, maybe I'll write it again. OVN.net/SH17. So let me remind you what we said last time. So we wanted to prove the Brouwer fixed point theorem. Gee, I forgot what it says, but we reduced it to there does not exist a retract from Dn to Sn minus 1, but since n minus 1 plays a bigger role in what we do later than n, I've added 1. So now we need to talk about a retract from Dn plus 1 to Sn. Right, this is Brouwer's fixed point theorem in dimension one more. So we need to show that there is no map from Dn plus 1 to Sn, no continuous map from Dn plus 1 to Sn, such that this diagram is commutative, which really says that you stretch Dn plus 1 to its boundary, you cannot stretch Dn plus 1 to its boundary while keeping the boundary in place. Okay? And then the strategy, by the way, there are easier proofs of the Brouwer fixed point theorem, okay? But, so we've set it as a goal, not really because this is the goal and because we want to show the easiest proof, but because we want to show the proof that will teach us the most, okay? So the way we prove it is by finding a functor from the category of topological spaces to the category of abelian groups that has the properties that this functor Hn applies to the n plus 1 dimensional disk is 0 and applied to Sn is z. If you apply the functor Hn to this diagram, you get a commutative diagram like this, zz factor through 0. But since you can't go from z to z and have a bijection by going through 0, this is impossible, therefore that was impossible. So that's the goal, find such a functor. And the idea, and the plan is to start realizing this idea, was to set Hn of x, so the nth singular homology group of x, to be, roughly speaking, whatever that would mean, the collection of all n-dimensional sub-objects of x that have no boundary, modulo the collection of boundaries of n plus one-dimensional things. So roughly speaking, very roughly speaking, this measures n-dimensional holes. Right, because every n-dimensional hole can be surrounded by something n-dimensional without boundary, and since it's a hole, it's not the boundary of something n plus one dimensional. This is very rough, what I just said. Okay, so now we want to make it precise. So, first of all, what's an n-dimensional object in a general topological space? I mean, you might think general topological spaces are too wild too. I mean, well, how would you say anything like that at all? But that's actually reasonably easy. All you have to do, so suppose I had a crazy topological space, and I wanted to talk about three-dimensional things in it. All I have to do is to pick some model three-dimensional thing, I don't know, a cube, and ask myself, how can I map this cube to this space? The image of that cube can be fairly thought of as being a three-dimensional object in that space. Now, if I wanted to construct more complicated three-dimensional objects, maybe I would take several cubes. So one cube would go here, another cube would go adjacent to it, and by making such Lego constructions, I could make bigger and bigger three-dimensional objects, or five-dimensional, or two-dimensional objects inside the, my topological space, no matter what it is. I mean, it could be infinite-dimensional, it could be completely crazy. Okay? So basically, that's the idea. One difference is that it turns out that cubes are a bit make messy definitions. I don't think I want to go into exactly why, but somehow they're not comfortable to work with. And it's a bit easier to work with triangles and the n-dimensional definitions, n-dimensional generalizations of triangles. So instead of mapping lines and squares and cubes and then four-dimensional cubes, we will map into our space lines and triangles and simplices and so three-dimensional simplices and so on. Okay? So then first step is to remind you what the n-dimensional simplex is. Okay? So far for introductions, and now we start with definitions. So definition, the n-dimensional simplex, okay, is the following set. It's the set of all points T inside R n plus 1. So it turns out that it's actually best to think of the n-dimensional simplex as lying inside Rn plus 1, okay? So it's the set of all t inside Rn plus 1 with the property that all the coordinates of t are non-negative, and the sum of all of these coordinates, so sum here I goes from 0 to n, I guess I should have told you that my coordinates run from coordinate 0 to coordinate n, okay, is equal to 1. Okay? So, examples. What is the one-dimensional simplex? So, the one-dimensional simplex, as defined here, should be a subset of R2. It's the subset of the R2 whose coordinates are T0 and T1. And both T0 and T1 should be positive, or sorry, non-negative. So it lies in the upper quadrant, in the upper right quadrant. And it's the set of points that go from, I guess, this point whose coordinates is 1, 0, to this point whose coordinates are 0, 1. And connected by a straight line, basically this is the line whose equation is T0 plus T1 is equal to 1. So T1 is a triangle. Of course, I started in the, Delta 1 is a line, an interval, okay? Now, what's Delta 2? So likewise, Delta 2 lies inside R3. So here is, my best drawing of R3. I guess if this point is the unit, the standard basis element E0, and this point is the standard basis element E1, then in R3 I will have three of them. So I'll have an E0, an E1, and an E2. So this is the point 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1. And I'm looking for all, basically, the plane that passes through these points, right? Because these points satisfy all of these conditions. So such a plane, and the intersection of that plane with the upper octant, I guess, not quadrant. So that looks like a triangle like this, which is sort of away from the origin, but, well, that's my model. Okay? Well, I cannot draw delta 3, but delta 3 will be a three-dimensional simplex line in R4. But, of course, I should have started by drawing delta 0. So what's delta 0? Well, it lies inside R1. it is the point inside R1 whose sum of coordinates is equal to 1. Namely, its only coordinate is 1, so it's a single point. Okay? Good. Now, I can actually talk about simplices, and in a minute it will matter. I can actually talk about simplices in arbitrary vector spaces. So, if V0 up to Vn are vectors in a vector space V, and in fact they don't even have to be linearly independent. Okay, the simplex may crash into itself. They don't have to be linearly independent, they don't have to be a basis, they don't have to generate, they don't have to do anything. So given any such collection, I can talk about the simplex, which is a convex hull, the simplex of linear combinations of Z's with sum of with all coefficients positive and sum of coefficients equal to 1. Okay? But in fact, I can do something even nicer, and this is I can map, I can define a function from the standard simplex into the vector space whose image would be this convex hull. And the function, so the name for the function would be V0 up to Vn inside square brackets. It will be a function from the standard n-dimensional simplex and with values in V. And you should, again, the image of that function will be that. Anyway, what's the function? So the function should take an element in the standard simplex, so it should take T into the vector space. Well, T is just a list of numbers, T1 up to Tn, so I'll just map it to the combination of V0 up to Vn with these coefficients. So it will go to sum Ti Vi. Okay? So that's a simplex in a general vector space. That's just an aside, yes?
General vector space over the real numbers.
Yeah, over the real numbers, yes. Yes. So V is, I guess, over the real numbers. Okay. So now I can talk about simplices in a topological space. So, definition. So, Cn of x, so this is not quite the set of n simplices, but I'll say in a minute what it, I'll explain in a minute what it is. So this is the space of n chains, so-called n chains in x. So instead of thinking of the space of all n simplices, I will be talking, well, basically like here, I want to think of Lego constructs, about constructs that you can make by assembling many simplices together. So things here are not just made of one simplex, but of many. So it will be the set, as a set, it will be the set of all things of the form sum of ai sigma I, where I runs from 1 to some finite number. I don't care how big it is, it could be huge, right? It has nothing to do with the dimension. Okay, maybe, you can make a Lego construct with many, many pieces, even just in three dimensions. Okay? So it's the set of all such sums, such that each AI is an integer. So each coefficient is an integer. Like I can take one Lego piece 7 times if I want, or negative 1 times if I want. And such that each sigma I is a simplex. So each sigma I is in itself a function from the n-dimensional simplex into the vector space. into the topological space X. Okay? Now you can ask, what does this mean? So this is formal addition. Okay? It's just okay, what does formal addition means? Well, basically you know, I can, sorry, I'm, this is disturbing. So whenever you have a set, you can turn it into a vector space by declaring that the elements of this set are a basis. So simply by formally declaring that you're allowing myself, you're allowing yourself to take linear combinations of elements of that set. So if the set is this huge infinite dimensional set of simplices, you can still talk about all linear combinations of elements of that set. Okay? Okay? Now, I don't know, is this clear enough? I mean, is this, so it's a bit abstract, right? But so, you know, I can turn the students in this class into a vector space by allowing, let's take, you know, three nuzzers minus two up. No, I forgot your name.
Sanjet.
Plus seven Cameroons. And then if I subtracted three Cameroons, I'd have four Cameroons instead of seven. Okay, I mean, I can just turn any set to a vector space, even if it's infinite dimensional and the elements in it are bizarre. The zero element of this, except that it's not a vector space because I'm taking sums with coefficients in Z, but it's well, it's a module, if you want. So the zero element will be, well, you can think of it either as the empty sum or a sum with coefficients all zero, but that would be the zero element. Okay? Okay, again, I could give a formal definition, but I think it's good enough to think about it this way. Okay. Well, so now we know what are n-dimensional things in X. N-dimensional things in X are Z's. Okay? But I need to tell you what the boundary is. So I need to construct a map, which I will call the boundary map. And it should be going from n-dimensional thing in X into n minus one dimensional things in X. Okay? Now, how do you do that? So the idea is very simple. If I have an n-dimensional thing in X, what's an n-dimensional thing in X? It's a combination of simplices. So it's a combination of mapped into simplices. So it's a, you know what, let's do it one dimension down. So it's a combination of triangles. So the image of a triangle might be, I don't know, a triangle like this, okay? But then what's the boundary of a thing like that? Well, it's just this interval, union this interval, union this interval, and these intervals are simply the images of the edges of the original simplex. So I suppose I first have to tell you what are the edges of a simplex, or how do I think of the edges of a simplex? So if I have a simplex, let's again do the two-dimensional example. So again, you should think of it as if it's this one. So the corner of the simplex, the corners of this simplex are E0, E1, and E2. Okay? Now, the edges of that simplex are three maps whose domain is an interval. Okay? Now, the first map will go into, the first map in the standard ordering will go into here, will go into this edge. And this is the map that maps the two ends of this line to the two ends of that line. But we actually have a name for this map already. This is the map E1, E2. Right? This is the map that maps. So, right? Again, if I have n plus 1 vectors inside a vector space, it defines an n-dimensional simplex in that vector space. In our case, the n plus 1 vectors are E1 and E2, so that defines a one-dimensional simplex, namely an edge. And it's the edge that goes from E1 to E2. Likewise, there is a second map into the second edge, and into that edge, and it's the map E0, E2. And then there is a map into this edge, and it's the map E0, E1. So the first one was obtained by dropping E0. The second one was obtained by dropping E1. And the third one was obtained by dropping E2. Okay? Now, these are maps into the standard simplex. Suppose the standard simplex was mapped by some map sigma into another topological space. Then it would be fair to say that the boundaries of sigma are the compositions of sigma with these maps. Basically, that's exactly what the edges of the triangle in X correspond to. So therefore, definition, the boundary of a simplex sigma, assuming now that sigma belongs to Cn, will be the sum over all i's. I runs over which vertex am I omitting? Now, if we are in Cn, the simplexes are n-dimensional, so they have n plus 1 vertices. So I should be running from 0 to n. And then, how do I omit a vertex? I take basically the simplex that you get by looking at E0 up to En, omitting Ei. So again, if you took 257 with me, you know this notation. Probably you know this notation even if you did. This stands for E0 up to EI minus 1, skipping EI plus 1, and continue up to EN. And since this takes more chalk, the standard notation is to write the thing that you omit with a head on, with a hat on top. Okay? But then that should be composed with sigma so as to get into X. Okay? So I should have said CN of X. And that's almost right. And to make it right, the only thing you have to add is signs. And the signs are minus 1 to the power I. And I could spend some time explaining why this is the rational sign choice. But instead, we will simply wait and see that it works. Okay? But this is actually the rational sign choice. Okay. So is the definition of the boundary clear? I guess not fully, because this is for the case of an individual thing in Cn. But now if you have a combination, a linear combination of things, you simply extend linearly. So sum of aj sigma j will go to, via the boundary map, to the sum of AJ the boundary of sigma J. Everything okay? Okay. Good. So now I want to talk about boundaryless things and things that are boundaries. And this is a completely trivial definition. So, definition. So, the n boundaries in X is the following space. It's the space Bn, where Bn is the set of all things in Cn. So what should I call things in Cn which are not an individual simplex? I don't know. A's inside Cn. I suppose I should write Cn of x, but often I will omit the x when it's obvious from the context which x we're talking about. Such that the boundary of A is equal to 0. Okay? And then I need to talk about things which are boundaries. So my second definition will be, sorry, no, that's not n boundaries. These are things with no boundaries. What am I doing? The next thing is the things that are boundaries. So these are called cycles. So these are n cycles in X. Okay? And then the next definition is, sorry, and it's called Z. Sorry, I've confused my my definition. And then the second thing is the so-called n boundaries in X. And this is Bn. And this is the set of all boundaries of A, such that A is an n plus 1 dimensional object in X. And finally, I want to define, so I wish to define, to make exactly the definition that I made over there. So I wish to define Hn of X to be the set of cycles, the things with no boundary, sorry, not this thing, Zn modulo things that are boundaries, Bn. But for this definition to make sense, I first of all need to know that Bn is at all a subset of Zn. Right? You can only mod out this by that if that's a subset of that, subspace of that. So, claim, this is indeed the case. Bn really is a subset of Zn. Okay? But even before that, let me tell you a different way of saying the same thing. So Bn is a subspace of Zn if and only if something else holds. And I think I prefer to prove the other thing. Okay? So what's the other thing? So first of all, there are three spaces involved here. There is Cn plus 1. It appears here. There is Cn, it appears here, and when I take a boundary of something in Cn, I get something in Cn minus 1, so there is Cn minus 1. So three spaces appear in the business, and and two maps. And so I called both of these maps the boundary map. But in fact, there are different boundary maps. One is the boundary maps of n plus 1 dimensional things. The other is the boundary map of n dimensional things. So the tradition is to name maps, well, is either not to name maps or to name them after their domain space. So this will be called the n plus 1. and this will be called dn. Okay? And then the two subspaces that I'm talking about, both are subspaces of Cn. And a different way to say what they are is that Cn is the kernel of the map going that way. So it's the kernel of del n. And Bn is the image of del n plus 1. Okay, sorry, the image of del n plus 1. But now, to say that Bn is contained in Zn is the same as saying that the image of this map is contained in the kernel of that map, right? But saying that the image of this is contained in the kernel of that is exactly the same as saying that if you compose, if you go two steps, you get to zero. Right? If you, again, if the image is contained in the kernel, then going two steps takes you to zero. And if going to, and if the composition is zero, it means that anything in the image must have been in the kernel. So Bn is contained in Zn if and only if the composition here is zero. So del n plus 1 followed by del n is equal to zero. And the standard way of writing this is to say del squared is equal to zero. But that's a bit of an abuse of notation. Okay, are you with me? So my next claim will be that del squared is equal to zero. So far I've just switched languages. Okay, but the next claim comes after a few blackboard shots. Hey, I have to remind you, this is an informal class. I'm not in a hurry getting anywhere. There are no marks, no evaluations. If you listen, good. If you don't listen, also good. If I take my time taking pictures, that's my problem. Wow, so many pictures. Sorry, Naz. Okay. Okay. So next, I mean, but you know, I'm still somewhat curious if you're following me. So you know, if you're not, you should say something.
I was just wondering, like, the correspondence between this, because in 257 we did something that looks exactly the same, but...
Right, so in 257 there was an operator D,
yeah,
and it was actually raising degree instead of lowering degree. So del takes n plus one dimensional things to n dimensional things, but D took n forms to n plus one forms, yet it still satisfied D squared is equal to zero. It's some sort of a dual of that. Not exactly a dual, because the context is slightly different. Like, here there is no smoothness. Okay? But in good situations, D is the dual of boundary. And in fact, that is the content of Stokes' theorem. Right? Stokes' theorem precisely says... Well, what does Stokes' theorem say? Well, remember? Something like... The integral over m of omega over the boundary of m is equal to the integral of d omega over m. Okay? And, you know, if you recall what duality means or what the adjoint of a map means, then this means that the adjoint of taking the boundary is taking the exterior derivative. Okay, so that's the our relationship between the things. Okay? Anyway, we don't need this now. Okay, so okay. So claim, well, what we want actually happens. So del squared of any sigma is equal to zero. So I'm going to give a proof, but I'll sort of, it will be a tiny bit sketchy, and I'll leave a little bit to you to complete. Okay? So, okay. So I need to compute the n boundary, right, what was it, the, sorry, so I want to start from a sigma here and show that when you get here, it's zero. So I want to compute the nth boundary of the n plus first boundary of sigma. Maybe I should have said here that sigma is an n plus 1 simplex. Okay? So I want to do that. Okay? This is by definition sigma n, so sorry, del n, the nth boundary of the n plus first boundary of sigma, which is sum I goes from 0 to n plus 1 of the looking at the ith side of this simplex, so e0 up to e n plus 1 with ei omitted, and then applying sigma. Okay? Yes?
And the sign.
Oh, and the sign. Sorry, the sign is crucial. Minus 1 to the I. Okay? But now I can compute. So this is a linear combination of simplices. And I had a formula before for what is the boundary of a linear combination. Namely, it's the linear combination of the it's a linear combination of boundaries. Right? So I just need to take basically del n into here and take the boundary of that. But rather than doing it in full, I will do it in sort of, I'll just tell you what it comes out to be. And it should be rather clear that it makes sense. So basically, taking the boundary drops one EI, right? If you have a three-dimensional simplex, taking its boundary is the sum of all ways of dropping a vertex so as to get the opposite face. But now if I take the boundary of the opposite face, I end up dropping another vertex of that face so as to get the opposite edge of to that face. So overall, I will get that this is a sum over all possibilities of dropping two things from the original simplex. So it will be a sum as I is less than j is less than n plus 1 of some coefficient times the simplex that you get by looking at e0 up to en plus 1, dropping ei and ej, and then mapping it into x. Okay? So it's going to be something along these lines. But now the question is, what is the coefficient that comes here? The coefficient that comes here comes from two places. There are two ways you could have dropped EI and EJ. One way is there are two ways you could have gotten to this edge by dropping EI and EJ. One way is by first dropping EI, so at the first step you drop EI, and then at the second step you drop EJ. The other way is by first dropping EJ and then dropping EI. If you first drop EI, the sine that you get is minus 1 to the I, and then you drop EJ. But J, the jth vertex, becomes the J minus first vertex after you've dropped the ith vertex. So the next, so the contribution from the second dropping will be minus 1 to the J minus 1. But if you drop them in the other order, given that J is the later one, if you drop first EJ, the contribution will be minus 1 to the J, but then the ith remains the ith vertex. So dropping it would give minus 1 to the I. But these two signs are opposite to each other, so this thing adds up to 0, and therefore the overall result is 0. Okay? Did you follow? So basically, I'm dropping two vertices, and the convention is that when I drop a vertex, I do it with sine, and the sine is equal to its place. Okay? And then it's serial number. And then if I drop them in one order, then, in both cases I get two sines, but in one case one of the vertices first shifts to become the vertex one before. And then you get an opposite sign. Okay. Good. So now, so now I can make the definition. So definition, Hn of x, the so-called nth singular homology group of a topological space X is hereby defined to be just what I said it would be, Zn over Bn, or said differently, the kernel of del n modulo the image of del n plus 1. Okay? And So we're almost done, right? The only thing that remains is to prove all the good properties, and that will take some time. Okay? But before that, a few examples. So, examples. One, let's compute Hn of a single point. Okay, you know, we're aiming high, but first we have to start with a single point. What's the homology of a single point? Okay? So, to compute Hn, I first have to compute this sequence of spaces Cn, the spaces of, I think I call them chains, n-dimensional chains. So I need to tell you what is C0, what is C1, what is C2, what is C3, and all that. Now, what is C0? C0 is the set of all maps of a zero-dimensional simplex, namely a single point, into my topological space, which is a single point. There is only one such map. So C0 is it actually isn't a single element, right? It's generated by a single element. There is only one zero-dimensional simplex, but in the definition of Cn, I allow linear combinations. So it's the vectors, or the Z module, the vector space over Z, generated by one element, and that's just Z. Okay? Now, C1 is the set, or is generated by the set of all maps from an interval into a point. How many maps are there from an interval into a point? One. The whole interval goes to the point. So this is again one-dimensional, but again it's not one-dimensional, it's rank one, So it's just z. The set of linear combinations with coefficients in z of a single element. Okay. C2 is the set of maps from the, is generated by the set of maps from a triangle into a one point. There is only one such map, but I take linear combinations, z. C3 is z, and so on. Okay? But in order to compute homology, I also need to know what are these arrows. Okay? Maybe I'll start with C2. What's the boundary of a triangle? The boundary of a triangle, well, what's a triangle? A triangle is really just the whole triangle collapsed into the single point, right? Now, the boundary of that triangle will be the sum with sines of the three edges of that triangle. Each of these edges, sorry, I'm going the wrong way. The arrows go, The arrows go this way. Right? Okay. So each edge of the triangle is the generator here. Triangle is two-dimensional. Each edge of a two-dimensional triangle is just the only one edge there is, the only one-dimensional edge there is. So we have three times, so the map that appears here is a sum with sines of three times the map which maps the generator here to the generator here. Now, the first summand does it with some plus. The second summand does it with some minus. And the third summand does it with sine plus. So the map going from here to here is the map 1 minus 1 plus 1, and this is the map 1, multiplication by 1. Okay. I keep being confused about where I'm putting things. Yeah, this is the right thing, right. Now, here, three-dimensional objects have, so three-dimensional simplices have four faces each, right? A three-dimensional simplex has four faces. Each face map will be just the identity map, but they come with alternating sums. So the map going from here to here is the map 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1, and that's the zero map. And it will keep going this way, alternating. So basically, I will get a chain of these. And the maps between them will be, well, this will be the zero map. Then this will be the one. This will be zero. This will be one. This will be zero, and so on. OK? So next, I need to find what are bn and zn. I think my ordering was Cn and then Bn. So Cn was the kernel of these maps. So the kernel, okay, I should have said at the start that I to make H0 make sense as well, I artificially extend all such chains by zero. So I declare that the boundary of a point is zero. Okay? So the kernel, so C0 will be the kernel of the map from Z to zero, and it's Z. Okay. Z1 will be the kernel of the map, of the zero map. The kernel of the zero map is again Z. Z2 will be the kernel of the identity map, which is 0. Z3 will be the kernel of the 0 map, so it's Z. And then 0 and so on. Okay. Now, Bn are the images. The image of the 0 map is 0. The image of the identity map is everything. The image of the 0 map is 0. Is zero. The image of the identity map is everything. the image of the zero map coming from here is zero, and so on. And now if I summarize, I find that so HN of a single point is equal to, and then there are cases, if N is equal to zero, so if I'm in the first column, I have to take Z modulo nothing, do not mod out by anything, Z modulo zero, and the answer is Z. Everywhere else, you mod out Z by Z, you get zero. Zero by zero, you get zero. Z by Z, you get zero. So if N is greater than zero, you get zero. So that's our first homology computation. Are you still with me? Okay, good. So maybe we should take a 10-minute break and continue at 6.